Oscar Podcast. Oscar Podcast. I'm here with Craig Kennedy from livingincinema.com and myself and Ryan Adams from awardsdaily.com, and we're talking about the Oscar race. I think this year, the later the movies that come up, the harder it is for them to win Best Picture, because I do think that you need that reflection time to figure out which movie really is the best of the year.
At the same time, though, there seems to be a habit, and maybe it's just me this year, but every time a new movie comes up, it seems to be the new favorite. And I'm thinking about Argo. When that came out, I thought, oh, well, there's your winner. Mm-hmm. But then I finally saw Lincoln, and now I'm thinking, well, okay, well, maybe it's Lincoln. But now, am I responding to the movies, or is it just, am I responding to them being the flavor of the minute?
I think it could partly be because there are just so many good movies this year that just as we think we found our favorite, another favorite comes along. And that's only because there are so many really great movies this year, more than usual.
That's right. So a movie like, for instance, Silver Linings Playbook, which won the Audience Award in Toronto. But it's worth remembering that it won that award because it came in with no information and really low expectations, and it wowed the crowd and it won. You can't pull that rabbit out of the hat twice, though. That's just a one-trick pony if the movie doesn't have the stuff. I don't know if it does or not. I'm not passing judgment on it. All I'm saying is that compared to the other movies that I've seen, it feels slight, and it feels like a kind of a light-ish romantic comedy. And we can talk about in a minute, we can talk about the kinds of movies we think that the Oscar voters tend to favor. And that makes it an uphill battle for Silver Linings. Not to say that it can't win. It has a chance, just like all the other ones, of course. But up against a movie like Lincoln, you know, and even Life of Pi and Argo and maybe Les Mis and Zero Dark Thirty, those are really hard-hitting, hardcore movies, a lot of them. And Silver Linings isn't. So maybe that makes it stand out. Maybe it makes it separate from the rest of them because they're all sort of heavy and dramatic and, you know, tear-jerkers. And then Silver Linings is just kind of like, a little mini success story in one tiny corner of America.
Do you think it's hard for critics to a degree and also awards groups to a degree to take a movie seriously when it's enjoyable, kind of?
Yeah, for sure. I think you can count on one hand the romantic comedies that have won. Like, the best comparison you can give for Silver Linings is As Good As It Gets, which didn't win Best Picture. And then you got to go back farther to The Apartment, which they used last year for The Artist when people were saying it was too light, too much of just a love story to win.
It didn't. Maybe win. Terms of Endearment.
Terms of Endearment was like a mother-daughter cancer movie, though.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it did have that cancer aspect.
What about Shakespeare in Love? How would you categorize that one? That one is still maligned to this day because it had the nerve to beat the big drama that year. Saving Private Ryan.
And you could see a repeat of that this year. People are going to want to say that it's Silver Linings, but it's actually Argo. Argo's more like Shakespeare in Love because the reason Shakespeare in Love had seriousness to it, first of all, it's a serious movie and a comedy. But what was serious about it was Shakespeare, And so automatically there's more at stake. And that's the same with Lincoln, and that's the same with Argo, because and I guess Zero Dark Thirty, because there's already all that history built up with that person. And so if Shakespeare in Love was about, you know, Sam, you know, Johnson, who lived in Kansas and had written this play, never would have won Best Picture. It had to have the Shakespeare component. It was also a dazzling script. I mean,
Because it also played on Shakespeare's own comedies. It played off of the way that Shakespeare's own comedies worked in their time.
Yeah, and like Argo, it made jokes about Hollywood all throughout, like modern day Hollywood. You know, the guy who's rowing the boat. As it happens, I happen to be a bit of a writer myself, and he hands him his screenplay, you know. I mean, Hollywood loves jokes like that on Hollywood, obviously. So, and that's Argo. You know, Argo doesn't have the beautiful, heart-stopping romance of Shakespeare in Love, but it has the same wit in the script. And I'm sorry, but Shakespeare in Love is a really great movie. I've seen it 20 times at least, and I'll stand by that as the better film than Saving Private Ryan. It's my opinion, but... it's a perfect film, Shakespeare in Love. It has very little... It's not like it has a sloppy third act, for instance, or... Right?
Yes, exactly. I was going to say that's. It's not that Shakespeare in Love is so much better in every part as Saving Private Ryan, but Saving Private Ryan has more flaws.
Right, exactly. And so you got to look at that now, and Silver Linings Playbook, as emotionally effective as it is a very flawed movie. It's like The Fighter, you know, it's David O. Russell, so it's a sloppy at the edges. It's, you know, it's his heart on the page, and there's a lot about it that's good and a lot about it that's not good. But in a year like this one, up against all these other movies, I would be shocked if it managed to pull out a win myself. But we'll have to see how it goes. I'm trying to be nice.
To what extent do you think the good feeling we're having about the election will that impact Lincoln's chances, since there's such a direct link, even though it's never directly made in the movie?
Well, I tell you, if the Oscars were held today, Lincoln would win.
It can only help. It can only help. It can only influence people. It cannot turn anybody off.
However, since the Oscars don't exist in a vacuum, we still have all these months to go before February. And I don't, right now, the will for, you know, there is a lot of goodwill for Obama. We're feeling pretty confident, positive, and progressive about our choices. And it resonates. When you're watching Lincoln now, it resonates. Everything that's happening in our world. But come February, I don't know. I don't know what this Petraeus thing is going to do. I don't know what, you know, it could lead to impeachment hearings. You know, I wouldn't be sure.
I mean, it could, but wouldn't that be just ridiculous? There's just, right now, I don't see any substantiation for that whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm just saying that it could change. Our feeling, our mood could change. As it is, though, Craig, what do you think? You saw Lincoln.
I think it will. I mean, like you said, our attitudes about the election may change between now and then, and there's still a lot of movie to come out, and I am suffering a little bit of the flavor of the minute with Lincoln, but it's just, we are talking about serious movies versus not serious movies, and I think a movie can be entertaining if there's something about it that makes the voter feel smart, like you were talking about with Shakespeare in Love, having the Shakespeare component made you feel smart liking that movie, whereas...
I know what you're saying. You should never say that, because I know what you're saying. I think most people, other people listening do too. One thing that's going to... it's not as if the election is the last enthusiastic moment we're going to have for Obama for the next few months. There's the inauguration coming up. It's going to be a huge deal, and that's in the middle of January.
That's freaking in January, right. Man. That's like right around the time of... I mean, the timing for Lincoln wasn't planned, but it couldn't be better. Like, let's just go over this again, because I keep writing this because I want people to remember the importance of this in terms of... Oscar history and film history and American history. Doris Kearns Goodwin took 10 years to write the book Team of Rivals. Tony Kushner spent 6 years writing the screenplay for Lincoln. Daniel Day-Lewis and Steven Spielberg just talked about his role for the entire year before they ever even started filming. I mean, you're talking about the most intense preparation, that, you know, painstaking, exacting attention to detail here with this movie. And I think Hollywood folks, Oscars are driven by actors. This is an incredible ensemble piece of veterans like Sally Field and James Spader and David Strathairn and, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis and Tommy Lee Jones. I mean, these are, and Hal Holbrook. I mean, so you take the combination of the most beloved American president ever, and you take one of the most beloved directors in Hollywood, the most beloved actor, and I'm sorry, I think you have to be blind or stupid not to recognize the greatness of this moment with this film. Could be wrong, we'll see, but...
Well, the reviews back you up. You're not alone in feeling that way.
Right, and it's also the highest reviewed film right now.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
I think also, and I don't know whether maybe... shit, my brain is just so fucked. There's going to be a lot of below-the-line love for this movie in terms of the production design, the cinematography, and all the technical stuff. And do you guys think, as Oscar watchers, that that increases its chances of, in the Best Picture race, having all of that other category love?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it, I don't know the stats exactly, but I think there's been many, many times when the movie with the most Oscar nominations wins the Best Picture, and that's because people across the board in every category are enthusiastic about the work that they've seen, that their own craft has contributed to the film, and they're proud of it even if they weren't associated with it, because they see what the art directors can do, what the costume designers do. So all of those different factors within the Academy are enthusiastic about the movie.
Absolutely.
And it's also the first thing that people report when the nominations come out, is which movie got the most nominations, as though that's a reflection of something, but it crystallizes people's attention on a specific movie that way.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Thompson's thing of how do you build Best Picture? You build it branch by branch. Well, you can't, most of the time, movies that have the tech nom, you know, the below the line stuff, wrapped up, usually don't have the actor part of it, because the actor part of it is really the controlling. That's why you often have movies like Hugo that wins everything, but, and then you have a movie like The Artist or The King's Speech winning the heart of the awards because it's so actor-centric. Mm-hmm. But Lincoln is both. Lincoln is like Titanic. It's like Schindler's List. It's like one of those movies that has both the below-the-line stuff and the acting and the directing and the writing. Fucking Tony Kushner's screenplay. You know, nobody's going to beat him for adapted screenplay. There's no way. Nobody else has a shot at that award except him. So, and Daniel Day-Lewis is going to win actor. Well, you know, just start ticking them off. Daniel Day-Lewis for actor, you know, screenplay, and then Spielberg's probably going to win director, and that is your Best Picture. You know, it's like looking at Obama state by state. It's like, you know, your most likely path to the win is all of these factors together.
Silver Linings can have the popular vote, but Lincoln's going to win in the Electoral College, goddammit.
Oh, God, that's a good
one. Can we talk for a minute? I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
No. Do you want to talk about your Four Seasons thing, can you? Or do you want to write about that and not talk about
it? I don't really want to ever mention it again, and let's just pretend it never happened. But I would like to talk about Sally Field for a second, because obviously a lot of the attention's on Daniel Day-Lewis, and deservedly so, because the dude is amazing. I mean, I don't know how you can play an icon like that and disappear into the icon and make him a human being at the same time. It's just incredible. But it was so wonderful seeing Sally Field again, because I think it's been so long since she has... There was a stretch there where she was sort of seemed like an Oscar given. But now, as we seem to think about her, is the one speech that she gave, "You like me, you really like me," and that she's almost a punchline. And she's been good on TV, but it's like I'd almost forgotten what a wonderful actor she is, and she's so terrific in this movie, and just the fact that they gave so much of the movie to his wife, I think, is amazing as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, Mary Lincoln was crazy. The son ended up having her committed after Lincoln died. She ended up in an insane asylum. But Sally Field, this is what we were talking about, Craig. This is what I was trying to remember, which was that, you know, we're so used to seeing actors now who are just kind of plucked from obscurity, and they're there because they're charismatic or they're cute or they're pretty, and then they give these performances, and we're supposed to say, you know, that's pretty good for a really pretty girl. She's pretty good.
Right.
She's really good. Oh, wow, that was a good performance. But it's a whole other thing when you see someone who is really good, you know, who is that good as Sally Field. She's a pro. and she's totally showing you how it's done. I mean, she will be showing all the younger generations of actors how it's fucking done. And she gained a whole bunch of weight for the part, and her delivery. She makes a lot of it. My only question is, are they going to run her for lead or for supporting? I think it's supporting, but I don't know for sure.
I would say supporting, just my gut instinct. Not having seen the film yet, but it seems to me that her screen time is probably would indicate supporting. And if they're smart, I would think supporting too, because that way you don't have to worry about putting her up against the lead actors who carry the movies all on their own.
Hmm. Right.
What a wonderful year for older actors, and I think people are realizing the wealth of that you get from a lifetime of experience that can go into a performance. I mean, look at all of the actors in Exotic Marigold Hotel, which is considered a slight movie, but it's grounded by these performances and these actors who've mm-hmm. been there and done that and seen the ups and the downs. And then there's Amour and even Mary Todd Lincoln. It's a great year for older actors.
Right, and then there's Quartet coming, which is about four different older actors. And in Cloud Atlas, they have some wonderful performances in that as well. It's nice to see them, you know, going against the idea that they all have to be young, hot actors, you know, that there's still room to be, you know, for a lot of us to learn from, you know, interesting people who've lived such long and varied lives. But I have, right now, I have Daniel Day-Lewis, Tommy Lee Jones, and Sally Field all three to win, while only two movies in history have ever won three acting Oscars, and that one was, and neither of them won Best Picture. One was for Network, Peter Finch, and Beatrice Straight, and who was the other one that won on Network? Was it Ned Beatty?
Did Faye Dunaway not win?
Won Faye Dunaway. And then the other one was...
Streetcar Named Desire.
Streetcar Named Desire. And then that, who won in those?
Everybody but Brando.
Everybody but Brando. So Vivian Leigh and Kim Hunter and Carl Malden.
Mm-hmm. And Vivian Leigh, they won.
It's such a good movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're getting to that kind of territory with Lincoln. You're in that territory. You're not like, I have to accommodate for this 20-something girl who really doesn't have any experience and is okay, she's fine. Mm-hmm. But in Lincoln, it's like pro, just like Vivian Leigh and Marlon Brando and Kim Hunter and Carl Malden. I mean, you're in that territory of those kind of actors.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's possible Lincoln could win all three and then not win Best Picture. You know, it's possible. So if we do decide that it's going to be Lincoln, it's probably not going to be three Best Acting prizes. And by the way, Tommy Lee Jones would be winning his second, Sally Field would be winning her third, and Daniel Day-Lewis would be winning his third.
That's really rare, right in itself. What other actors, not even very many actors at all, have won three Oscars?
That's
and none have won three lead actor awards, have they?
A lot of people have those stats down. I'm totally not one of them.
Yeah, I don't think any actor has won three best lead actor awards.
No,
I
they
think
have.
The only Let's... ones have won. Have they?
Oh, sure. Let's look it up really fast. Do a quick Google.
I'm pretty sure that the ones who have won three, the actors who have three Oscars, some of those are supporting awards. That's what I'm.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that. But yeah, I have that page in front of me that on filmsite.org right now, and it looks like that I can't see anyone who's won three Oscars that were all lead category.
Really? Wow, that would be so incredible if that turned out to be true.
Yeah.
So most Best Actor Oscars won.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you want to look at, right?
Right. I wish I could send you the link real quick. It's just slash best actor.
Oh, on the film site?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm. / best actor.
Let's see.
Pause. Dead air.
Oh, my God. So, acting. One actor has won four Academy Awards for Best Actress, Katharine Hepburn.
Mm-hmm.
Four actors have won three Academy Awards. Ingrid Bergman, she won two Best Actress, one Supporting. Jack Nicholson, two Best Actress, one Supporting. Meryl Streep, two Best Actress, one Supporting. And Walter Brennan, three Supporting.
Mm-hmm. Spencer Tracy, did he win three or two?
It doesn't say here, but it probably won three.
Yeah. I think he won three, but maybe one of those was supporting. I'm not even sure.
Daniel Day-Lewis won't win?
No, I'm not. We can't really make. There's no. I don't think there's. I think whenever you have a precedent, that precedent can always be broken. You know, I'm not. I don't think that, that we have to make a rule that just because it's never happened before means it can never happen.
And if anybody's going to break the rule, it's going to be Daniel Day-Lewis. I mean, come on. Yeah. Not only is he great in this role, but he's. I'm not sure I realized how great he was until There Will Be Blood came out, and not just watching him in that movie, but he did a Q&A afterwards, and he's so entirely unlike any of the performances that he's ever given. He's this gentle, sweet English guy, you know, and yet in his movies he's so incredibly intense. And if you think about the range of his performances, you see him in Age of Innocence is on one end of the scale, then There Will Be Blood is on a completely, or Gangs of New York is on a completely other side of the scale. Lincoln kind of falls somewhere in the middle, and it's just the guy's all over the map, and he's just amazing. One of those actors that is just able to completely transform himself.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely forgot I was watching Daniel Day-Lewis in them. I really felt like I walked away having spent time with Lincoln. That's how
right, and not in a cheesy Disney's Hall of Presidents kind of way. It wasn't just a wax figure of Lincoln. It was really Lincoln, and not Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
Like I said to you guys earlier today, on the cover of the paperback edition of Doris Kearns Goodwin's book Team of Rivals, they have Daniel Day-Lewis's picture on the cover of her biography of Lincoln, and it seemed perfectly okay to do that because he's so recognizable as Lincoln. But right. it's a little bit strange though to have an actor on the cover of a biography.
I know, and it's such an iconic work that's the kind of thing where you expect he's going to win. Now let's talk about quickly who might beat him. Well, there's Joaquin Phoenix for The Master. I don't think he's going to beat him. But only because I'm not saying it's not as good a performance, because it's a really, really good performance.
With the baggage that it may be attached to it, it's going to turn some people off. I hope it doesn't affect too many people, because I think that's extraneous, and I don't like to think that Oscars are chosen that way, although I know they are.
I don't think it's the baggage so much. I think it's that Lincoln's a more likable character. They tend to vote for likable characters when they have the option, and Lincoln's really likable, and to turn away from that kind of likability and pick someone else just on skill, it rarely happens. That's what I'm learning now after all these years.
Right. The most likable person in American history against the most despicable person.
Exactly.
It's a toss-up. It's like the election, basically.
So who else is likable? Well, there's going to be Hugh Jackman in Les Mis, who's never won. And there's going to be Jamie Foxx, who has won, actually. So, and then Denzel Washington, who's also won. So those are your strongest contenders, I think, right now to take over Daniel Day-Lewis's part. But Les Mis is going to have to be A++++ across the board to challenge Lincoln. It's going to be its main challenger for the ensemble prize at SAG, but I still think Lincoln will win that. And
because of the script, right? The fact that Les Mis, the dialogue is sung. I think that actors really like to hear monologues that have some meat to the bone. You know, give the actor a chance to soar. And I don't know that singing the dialogue gives an actor the same opportunity to do that.
Right.
Well,
I think I did the research or something. It's like 1938 or 1946 or some year like that was the last time an actor won for a musical. So it's really rare that it happened. Although I guess you could say The Artist was sort of a musical, but that's kind of a stretch.
Maybe Mary Poppins.
My Fair Lady, Rex Harrison.
Oh, yeah. All right. Did Rex Harrison win, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah.
I can't believe he won, but he did. But the other thing that only like a really veteran Oscar watcher would be able to pick up on this, but one thing that I'm not saying I am, I'm just saying that one thing I've learned about Hollywood over the years is that they don't just go, you know, judge the person on the film necessarily when you're talking about somebody like Steven Spielberg, who's like John Ford or Clint Eastwood or one of these other really, really important directors in Hollywood. So, while you can't imagine David Fincher getting beaten by Tom Hooper or Martin Scorsese getting beaten by Michelle Hazanavicius, you know. When you think of the DGA, when you think of these directors and what they've achieved, Spielberg coming back from many years of kind of questionable work, that's always kind of good, but not quite. And they were willing to give a Best Picture nomination to War Horse, even. That's how much they love Spielberg. So I think that the fact that he's coming back from a questionable phase, many decades of imperfect work, and now he's come up with Lincoln, is going to make a big difference, because the Oscar loves a comeback.
I think, too, about the DGA, don't TV directors get to vote? And I think directors like directors who have their roots in television, and Spielberg does, and Tom Hooper did.
Right. Yeah, sure. That's right. So let's just think really quickly of DGA, since DGA isn't going to inform Oscar this year, for nominations anyway. You're probably going to have Spielberg, and then you'll have Ben Affleck. Those are the two locks. And then you probably have David O. Russell, although he's going to have to go up against Quentin Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson from the Weinstein Co., those three. And then maybe Tom Hooper and maybe Catherine Bigelow and maybe Peter Jackson. I mean, you have to still consider The Hobbit. It's coming up. So to me, those are the DGA, the strongest DGAs, and I can't see any of them beating Spielberg for that. They love Spielberg at the DGA. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So
everybody except Jeff Wells loves Spielberg.
I know.
Which can only help Spielberg, I think.
Exactly.
It's like the enemy, the friend of my enemy is my friend or something.
Poor Jeff, he's not going to have a very fun year.
But then he brought it on himself. You know, when you take a stance like this, it's just, you're just asking to be, it's like, kick me. Really.
Here's a Lincoln spoiler for you. The lead character dies in the end. I hope that doesn't ruin anything for anybody.
That's the only bummer of watching the movie. It's like, you know what's coming.
Who plays John Wilkes Booth?
They don't show it.
They don't show that. Okay.
Mm-mm. My sister was grousing about the ending. A lot of people have been grousing about it, but I think it only really matters if you, the first time you see it. I think when I saw it the second time, I didn't think twice about it. It just seems so right. But
it didn't bother me at all the first time. I thought it was fine.
Yeah, she was like, "Oh, it's so abrupt. You know, it's too abrupt of an ending." And other people have said he should have ended it close. He should have ended it on the shot before the end.
I've heard that, yeah, but you know what? Assassination is pretty abrupt, and I think that's appropriate. You know, it just makes you feel the impact of having someone's brilliant life cut short like that.
Yeah,
just right. have the whole thing unplugged.
But the movie reclaims him by after the assassination, which they don't show, they just refer to. They come back to the speech that he gave at the end. I believe it was the speech at the end of the Civil War. And they play that, but obviously in Daniel Day-Lewis's voice. And it kind of reminds you of his historical impact didn't end with him getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's what I think people are... I'm not sure which shot they thought it should have ended on, actually, but...
I think I read someplace that they thought that as he's walking out the door down the hallway, like, and you know he's on the way to the theater.
Oh, is that what they think, that shot?
I think. They're so just like, okay, we know where he's headed, and just fade to black.
Oh, I see. Well, it's possible you could have ended it that way.
That's the easy choice, I think, but I think the one that Spielberg made is more interesting.
I do, too, and also... One of the vivid things about the book, as far as I know, since I've never finished it, I don't know if I'll ever finish
it. We should skip to the end, because I've heard someone said that really the last two chapters of the book are really all that the movie deals with.
The little details that she puts in the book, they drop in a bunch of those little clues and little inside jokes for people mm-hmm. who have read the book. And there's stuff that you wouldn't know unless you read the book. You'd just think, oh, well, that's that scene. But if, having read it, you know, oh, yeah, that's that thing. He's making an allusion to that. He's, you know. Like, for instance, you know that Lincoln was really sympathetic to animals. That was one of his characteristics. He was like, stopped the kids from putting hot coals on the backs of turtles and stuff like that. And So they have a line in there where he puts gloves on his hand, leather gloves, and he's like, and I only noticed this a second time, but he's like, you know, these should have been left on the cow. And it's totally one of the only, it's funny because he's making a joke about how bad they look on him and how much he doesn't like them, but it also kind of refers to his sympathy for animals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of stuff, like that you wouldn't know unless you read the book. They do pepper it with little references here and there through the whole book, not just.
That's nice. You know, Cloud Atlas did the same thing. There were dozens of little moments that were there only for people who've read the book. So if you're looking for something that's missing from the movie, you get a little wink about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, lots of stuff like that.
I'm going to have to read the book now. Will it take me 5 years, like Team of
Rivals? No, you'll love the book. You'll love the book. It's really, it's an easy read. And it's like like six short stories. And so that's a good way to digest it as six different stories.
Well, let's move on to talk quickly about, sorry for the abrupt, that's
no,
very
right.
cool.
You just assassinated me.
This is where we should end the podcast.
If only we'd ended it as a conversation sooner. Okay, so I wanted us to talk about the type of Oscar movie, like what makes an Oscar movie, and we're looking at a wonderful website called filmsite.org, which has just a lot of information about the Oscars, and because we wanted to see, like, of this year, you know, like, what kind of movies generally win.
Mm-hmm. And on filmsite.org, specifically, we're looking at a page where they group Best Picture winners by genre.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can determine which genres are most likely or most often win Best Picture and which rarely, if ever, do.
Right, right. So
should we tie this into why Skyfall doesn't have a chance in hell, even though Entertainment Weekly and some other places are trying to talk it up?
We can talk.
Yeah,
about
I think
Skyfall
so. I think we can mention that, and
I think there's
pretty easy to find a good reason for that too. We'll get into it later, maybe.
Let's talk about we can talk about Skyfall for sure. So people ask, well, do you think it has a chance to get nominated for picture or supporting actor or cinematography or sound? Those are the four possible Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
But according to this chart, 49%, 355 Best Picture nominees are dramas. And of that, 39% of all the winners are dramas. And then comedy is 14%, which is really small. Historical epic, 16%. Musical, 11%. Action adventure, 5%. So that's where Skyfall would fall in. War mm-hmm. movies, 8%. Suspense, 3%. Western, 4%. So suspense is the least likely to win. That makes uh-huh. Argo's chances a little bit slimmer. But historical epic would be 16%. That's where Lincoln fits in.
We could play around and say that Argo is a historical action adventure.
Yeah, or an epic historical drama. Or comedy.
Right. That's what's great about Argo is it jumps across and it blends so many genres together.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In 50 years, James Bond movies have received a total of 7 Oscar nominations and 2 wins, and the wins were for special effects in 1964 and 1965.
Wow.
I think the problem that action-adventure movies have, if you're going to have great, fantastic action set pieces that can sometimes take 10 or 15 minutes to unfold on screen, you don't have much time for character development, and you rarely have time for any acting, characterization, or any monologues. And I think that was one of the things that helped Jaws, although Jaws is definitely an action-adventure movie. That scene with Quint on the boat talking about the tragedy of the sinking of the Indianapolis, mm-hmm. was only, like, I think, 3/4 of a page on the script, but it was expanded to last for 4 minutes on screen. That gave the movie some substance and meat that a lot of action movies don't take time to include.
Yeah,
that's really true. Do you think Skyfall is as hyped as it is, and as well as people seem to like it, and as seriously as they're taking it? Do you think that it has that element to it? I didn't.
The only time that it came close, I think, was when Javier Bardem's character Silva, when he's talking about the Island of Rats, and how they exterminated the rats by letting them devour each other until there were only two rats left. That was the only time that it was elevated to the point of having a really great acting moment. Maybe the only other time was in the bar scene in Macau when he takes hold of the arm of the actress and once he lets her know he would like to save her. That was a really, really great acting moment. But other than that, there really weren't that many acting moments that stood out.
Right.
For me.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's enough. I don't think that's enough to elevate it to Best Picture level.
It has to overcome being a James Bond movie, and it's a huge stigma to overcome, just like Dark Knight has to overcome being a Batman movie. I mean, that's just the way, when we're looking at this list here on FilmSite, and the only genre that can make it in really is Western, and that seems to be the only one that has... for winning, right? Because E.T. was nominated, Star Wars, Clockwork Orange. I mean, it happens. But, and Skyfall is going to be a huge, huge, huge hit. Because remember how the Bourne movies did? They kind of came in and, it's the Bourne Ultimatum, is that the one that sort of swept?
It won best editing in both sound categories because they were extraordinary. It was extraordinarily well done in those categories. But that was a surprise, and I think it's a rarity that happens.
I feel like that's the best Bond could hope for, is getting on that level of, you know, where the Bourne movie went, is where this one can go.
As great looking as Roger Deakins' work is in Skyfall, I think there are a lot of great looking movies this year. There are just a lot of great looking movies.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine that beating even The Master or Lincoln
or Life of Pi.
Life of Pi is gorgeous, you know. That's the one that's going to win. It's going to win Art Direction, Cinematography, probably, and Visual Effects.
The action-adventure movies, the films that have been nominated for Best Picture, they almost always have one of those moments. Treasure Sierra Madre had you know, a lot of very philosophical speechifying going on, you know. The Mission, The Fugitive, well, maybe not The Fugitive, but Apollo 13 did. Like I said before, Jaws. They always take time to have that moment. You know, you can't, if you're going to have an Oscar... a best picture with you have to have a clip available you can show on Oscar night, and it can't just be running and jumping. It's got to be somebody talking.
Right. I agree. That's a good example to bring up. Treasure Sierra Madre. What a great movie that is. God, yeah. That's a great movie.
And it's all about the script, you know. And that's really as much as a really neat little intricate plot that we got in Skyfall. But the script didn't have a lot of really thoughtful, profound, you know, stuff going on in it.
In fact, a lot of it didn't make sense to me. Like, for instance, why did he rally all those forces just to go and kill Judi Dench? It just didn't make sense to me. Like, if he's a supervillain, doesn't he have a better plan than that? You know, than to just go and kill one woman? It just, to me, it seemed sort of like a 12-year-old's idea of villainy. You know, like, can he be saving, you know, something that's a little more important than I just want to... I mean, I liked the twistedness of it being mother. I liked the let's kill ourselves together. That was the only part of it that I really was semi-involved in because I thought, oh, I like that. You know, it's weird and creepy. But it just didn't make sense that he would have helicopters and people. Like, maybe he would just sneak in alone to try to kill her, but he had a bigger plan, you know?
Yeah.
Seems like a dumb plan for a really smart guy.
It really does. For so little profit. I mean, that's one thing. And most villains usually want some kind of a monetary gain. You know, they're after some sort of other thing besides just revenge.
He's smart enough to have planned to escape from that. Oops, spoiler alert, sorry.
Yeah,
he's smart enough to have planned that escape. You know, that's a pretty mastermind thing to do, really. But his only goal is, and then he misses her in that one scene shootout. He could have shot her then. Or, you know, I don't know. To me, it just didn't ring. But my daughter, Emma, loved it. And that's one good thing. She doesn't know anything about James Bond, and she really loved the movie. She loves Ben Whishaw, of course. But she was like, it was so cute afterwards. She was like, so what does Money Penny mean? What does Money Penny mean?
That's adorable.
Isn't that cute?
So all the stuff about the Aston Martin and everything was probably kind of went over her head too, maybe.
That car is an orgasm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's great when a car can get applause from the audience, spontaneous applause. When a car comes on screen and gets applause, that's amazing.
See, that's what I missed all that in the movie.
I feel like a grouch because that part of the movie bugged the crap out of me. It seemed like total fan service in terms of here's one for the fans, but it was ironic because the whole movie seemed to be trying to distance itself from from James Bond. It seemed the whole time wanted to be much more of a Jason Bourne kind of movie.
Totally.
But then there were those little things that it threw back in, and it just were trying too hard to make the fans happy, and it just kind of annoyed me. And I say that as a person who grew up, you know, loving James Bond, but it just felt schizophrenic and wrong to me.
Yeah,
it's like the least James Bond movie that I've ever seen. It's the least related to the James Bond canon as any of the films, any of the 23 films. And actually, I'm not a big fan of the entire series of films. I don't like any of the Roger Moore movies at all, and I can't watch those. And the only ones I like are Casino Royale and Skyfall. I'd say probably is my second favorite, and then the early Connery movies.
Nothing beats the Connery ones, though.
What?
Nothing really beats the Connery ones.
No, they do for me. I really like, because I really like the realism of the spy movies, and I think even Dr. No and Goldfinger were a little bit too campy for me.
Oh, see,
they're
like the camp.
More fantasy than anything.
Yeah,
that was my problem.
And especially in retrospect, they're really campy.
But why not just make a regular action movie? Why do they have to ruin James Bond? I mean, they're not ruining it, obviously. It's making a shitload of money. Everybody loves it. You love it. Everybody's told me that they think it's the best James Bond. So it's doing really well. I'm not complaining so much. It's just, with me personally, it's probably a dumb complaint. And I haven't seen any James Bond movie for, like, decades. So I don't even really know what I'm talking about, except for the fact that the ones I remember and love were James Bond movies, you know?
And they were fun. That's what you said today on Twitter, and that was such a really good point. They take this movie. Took all of the fun out of James Bond. The Skyfall has hardly any fun to it, unless you just get
bummer.
The thrill of seeing people killed and being put in jeopardy. There's a thrill to that, but it's not a lighthearted fun like the other Bond films.
In fact, we saw it with a packed, sold-out house, and the audience was not liking it. You know, wasn't like seeing the Avengers or anything, where the audience was fully engaged and there was a couple of people laughing and clapping, but it wasn't like what you would expect for a packed house of a sellout movie. You know,
I felt a little bit brutal. By it, and because I was not expecting it to be so unrelentlessly bleak and grim.
Right.
You know, it was really a hard, harsh, tragic story.
Yeah, it was a downer.
Yeah,
but it was also like just sort of the problem with The Dark Knight, which it has this kind of dilemma, is that it wants to be brooding and deep, but you know, when you drill down, you're still just talking about Batman. You know, and when you drill down in this, you're still just talking about a James Bond movie, you know. But
I read something, I forget, I wish I could remember where, so I gave him credit, but they were comparing The Dark Knight to Skyfall, how they even brought back the old mansion, and they brought, there's the Alfred character in Albert Finney, and there's so many things that they tried to draw parallels between The Dark Knight.
That's what I felt like. It was like he really borrowed heavily from Nolan, and he was trying to do to James Bond what Christopher Nolan had done to Batman, which is just regenerate him and make him this brooding, dark, tragic figure. Well, that kind of works with Batman because he's already that in comic books, but James Bond isn't that. You know, he's funny. He's in on the joke.
I will say that Ian Fleming's Bond was a really brooding kind of guy, and the movies never really captured the way the Ian Fleming novels. But that's a totally different thing, because that's not the James Bond that most people know. I agree with you that the James Bond that we love and grew up with is lighthearted and debonair and suave. That was a lot missing from this movie.
But that's a good point, that if it's Ian Fleming that they're trying to revive in the same way that, you know, a lot of these comic book movies try to get to. It's just like I was talking about with David Poland on Twitter. It just makes me sort of sad, you know, the whole thing, like that this fanboy generation thinks of this as deep, you know. It's just that they think.
Well, maybe this is an anomaly. Maybe they won't. Maybe it's not a new trend that they will not all be like this in the future, because this is the last Sam Mendes film that he'll probably, the last James Bond film that he will probably direct. I don't really mind myself. And aside from thinking that they were trying to replicate the same tone and mood as Dark Knight, I kind of like that both the Dark Knight and Skyfall both tried to be more of a crime thriller rather than fantasy adventures.
Yeah, I like them when they make sense, though. Like, at least in The Dark Knight, it was like the guy really did want to mess up the world. It wasn't just, I want to kill this one person. I felt like Skyfall missed a whole other dimension of evil that it could have gone after. So that this seemed like there was something a little more at stake than saving Judi Dench.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, I mean, yeah, I think that you're right. I mean, all the good things that you say about it have to be true, you know? It's not a bad movie at all. Craig, we're totally sourpusses about this whole thing.
Hello? We're the only two.
We're
on this little island. And you know what? I don't dislike it for trying to be different than James Bond. I just wish that it had been consistent and was fully committed to it. I felt like it wanted to have its cake and eat it, too. It wanted to be Jason Bourne and James Bond at the same time.
Right, right, right.
And it didn't work for me.
Well, I think that if they're going to do Bourne, they have to make it a serious evil. So can we talk a little bit about the new Les Mis trailer? What do you guys think about that? That just hit the other day, and everybody just on our site had a total geekgasm over it. It was like 800 comments or something about that. What did you guys think?
I made a comment on Facebook last night, and I hate to be this cynical, annoying person who's judging a movie based on a small impression like that, but the whole thing just kind of bored the crap out of me.
I don't think you're the target demo for it.
I must not be either, though, because I just feel like I've seen this movie already.
And it so badly wants you to take it seriously and to love it that I'm just not buying it. And it's not so much target audience, because some of my favorite movies are musicals. I love Singing in the Rain. I love Cabaret. But this one just seems, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't help but get caught up in it. I guess it's sort of designed for me. It reminds me of my old theater days. You know, I used to do theater way back when I was like 19 or whatever, and I loved doing plays. You know, hitting your mark, getting into the costumes, hanging out with theater people. All that stuff was so much fun, and watching Les Mis just sort of reminds me of that. Les Mis is such a celebration of theater geeks, you know.
I like the featurettes and the behind-the-scenes stuff of Les Mis better than I do the trailers, for the same reason, because I like to see how it's put together. I love seeing how they orchestrate all that and choreograph everything in reality, on location and on set. But actually, the film itself, it just looks like a little bit so fabricated to me.
Yeah, I know. I could see that. It's not your kind of thing either. Neither of you.
Maybe we'll be wrong, though, because, you know, like we said earlier, you can't judge a movie by the trailer.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I do think that, yeah, and in that way, we might as well say it, that the Academy, they're mostly male voters, and that makes selling a musical pretty hard, although they do have plenty of pretty eye candy like they did with Chicago, you know. Musical, 8% of the best.
And which titles? Let's look at the titles that have won Best Picture.
11% have won Best Picture for, well, we know Chicago did, My Fair Lady did, An American in Paris, West Side Story. Those are the ones I know of.
Chicago was the first one to win in over 40 years, right?
Right.
Sound of Music, which I'll never understand that. American in Paris. There were some really early ones like Broadway Melody and Great Ziegfeld, because I think back then in the 1920s and 30s, that was a really spectacular thing to see on screen, and then it became like not so much.
Well, if you look back, remember I did a column about box office and women. And Sound of Music made insane. It was like one of the number one. It was the number one box office.
Right, that explains it. I forgot about that.
Yeah. It ended up being one of the hits of the decade. It was so popular. So, back then they used to judge Best Pictures on how many people bought tickets. You know, how many people in the public loved the movie. It's so rare that happens anymore. But that's how it used to be.
How do we explain Oliver though?
Oh.
Oliver, 1968, because 1968 was otherwise had so many other great contenders that year.
That was a really weird year, because that was also the year that JFK, that Robert Kennedy was shot and Martin Luther King was shot. So it was a pretty insane year. It's weird that they would turn around and go for a musical. Actually, you could compare that year to this year if you wanted, because you could say, oh, Les Mis is going to win because, look, Oliver won in 1968. What was it up against?
Let me look real quickly. Wasn't it up against like Bonnie and Clyde, probably 1968 or not? Maybe it was a year later. I'll find out really quick here.
I should know. I should know that. Some years I know, and some years I don't.
That's we talked about that year, I think.
Yeah, we did.
In our previous podcast, something about it rings a bell that there was a lot of dark shit.
What about like Z? Was it Z?
It actually wasn't a very strong year. I'm looking at it now. There was Funny Girl, another musical. There was Romeo and Juliet, Rachel with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, I guess, was in that. The Lion in Winter was the other Best Picture nominee that year. So it wasn't actually that strong of a year. I'm thinking the year before when Bonnie and Clyde and those other movies were so great.
I think it's only remarkable that it happened to be a musical to win. Mm-hmm. But Oliver, I guess it was a big hit, too.
Yeah. Probably. And also, who directed that? Not David Lean. No, Carol Reed. Carol Reed. So, you know, he had never won, in spite of the fact that he did those great movies like The Third Man and all the other things he did in World War II. Maybe he was sort of like thought to be like, let's pay homage to this guy.
Mm. Yeah. That's a good point.
Because he did win Best Director, too, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, he did.
Well, all I would say about Les Mis is that, like, Zero Dark Thirty and Les Mis and The Hobbit and Django Unchained are really coming out late, you know? It's just pretty mm-hmm. pretty late for this to be happening. So that's going to make it harder for...
I don't think... Well, one thing about Les Mis, it's not the kind of movie that you need to head to think about too much for it to sink in. And I do think that it will benefit a little bit from the Avatar effect, that it will be so spectacular when people see it. They'll still be kind of jazzed about it for several weeks after they see it, before they realize that, I never want to see it again. and so maybe that will help Les Mis more than it will help some of the other latecomers.
Yeah. I agree. Well,
am I the only person on the planet who loved Lord of the Rings and couldn't give two shits about The Hobbit? Does that even make any sense that I feel that way? I can't explain it. I see the trailer and I just think, I've done this three times. I don't need to go back to this world again. And I kind of feel like the fact that they've turned it into three movies and Peter Jackson is just sort of retreading old territory, and I don't need to go there again.
I don't really like... I mean, I like the Lord of the Rings movies okay. I saw them once, and then I was done with them. But isn't that a horrible thing to admit?
No, it's okay. I had to keep seeing them again because there were so many versions. I wanted to keep seeing like the extended version and the extended 3D version and the Blu-ray. So I ended up seeing it two or three, four times, but each time it just got more and more tedious.
I could appreciate the achievement of them, but it was definitely not something I wanted to revisit. I know it's totally different from everybody else who reads my website. They all love that movie, but all three movies. But for me, one time was enough for all of them.
I grew up loving the books, the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit, and I thought the movies were terrific. It's just, this just feels cynical to me.
I don't
have that gene that makes me want to go back and revisit the same thing over and over again just because it was good once, you know?
Yeah. I absolutely agree that The Hobbit, to me, seems like the least substantial, most insubstantial of the two books. And it's been spread out over three installments for no particular reason but other than just to cash in, right?
It's a fun bedtime story for kids, basically, and they've turned it into this epic trilogy.
Yeah, that's right. I know. I hear what you're saying, but I feel like Peter Jackson just doesn't have anything else to do, so he might.
He's desperate for a hit after Lovely Bones.
Yeah.
But I do think that what he has done, though, by turning it into now a series of six films, he's turned it into a franchise like James Bond. Now we've got James Bond, Hobbit, you know, and so it will have that going against it. People have just seen so much of it.
That is so true.
But at least James Bond tries to reinvent himself every few years, as this current year is an example. It's mm-hmm. a totally different thing than what James Bond used to be, for better or for worse, but at least it keeps it fresh.
That is something about James Bond, that it does seem to always mirror. Each film seems to mirror something about the political and social mood of the times when they come out. And I like that about them, that they're constantly right. They have their finger on the pulse of the country's mood.
Yeah, they're a reflection of what's going on in terms of the mood, but also in terms of popular culture. I mean, one of the worst James Bond movies ever in my book is Moonraker, which was trying to capitalize on the whole Star Wars thing.
I know.
I loved Moonraker.
Did you really? Oh, my gosh.
Because I saw it when I was Emma's age, you know?
That's the other thing I love about James Bond, is that everybody has their own personal favorite and most hated, and they never seem to agree.
I even remember a line from Moonraker, which was, "Any higher, Mr. Bond, and my ears will pop."
Was that a sexual innuendo kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I missed.
Yeah, his hand on her leg or something.
I feel like the sex is just being squeezed out of all of our movies. It's like it doesn't even exist
anymore. Wanted to say that if they're going to go this way with James Bond, why not just go all the way and make it an R-rated movie? It would have been a lot better if we had some really hardcore sex scenes.
We're not gonna
because,
see
you know,
Daniel
that would be
Craig.
So hot.
In any kind of sex in this movie, I was so cheated. I felt like, are you kidding me? He parades around in that suit. We see him doing pull-ups, and we don't ever get to see him have sex or anything like that. He gets in the shower with one girl. Well, the Bond I used to know, he used to have all kinds of crazy sex.
The one time you see him in bed with the girl, he's just lying there, staring at the ceiling, and she's stroking him, like trying to get him in the mood. It's not right. It's just not right.
Well, the sexiest scene is between him and Bardem.
Yeah.
That's the only sexy scene in the whole movie, really. So that bothered me a little bit. I mean, not that I don't mind it if he really was bi or whatever, that would be fine. But
yeah,
I don't think that they were trying to make it go that way. But anyway, that's the only thing. It's like Jason Bourne, you know, all these other characters. It's like no sex, Dark Knight, no sex, you know. But here, James.
Because
Bond,
they have to be PG-13. That's the big shame about movies like this. I really wish there were more action adventure movies that were R-rated, so we could really get some hardcore stuff like that.
Yeah, but it just felt so weird and squeaky clean, and like this is what you know. Believe me, 13-year-old.
The MPAA needs to get its shit together and stop penalizing movies for having sex in them and letting them have violence. It's violent. Violence is okay, but sex is not. They need to rectify that so that there could be a PG-13 movie that does have sex in it.
There was nothing, though. There was no... It's like his sex was robbed from him. I just find this to be the case of most target demo movies now. And it's not like belittling the women. It's not necessarily sexism. It's... Someone had said that James Bond was the new sex symbol or the sex object in this movie. He was the sex object and not the women. Well, okay, so if he's a sex object, let him be the sex object. Can I see him in his underwear? God. So they were conflicted. It's like they wanted to make him titillating, but they knew that their audience was going to be mostly straight men, and so they didn't want to make him too titillating, although he is anyway. He can't help it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was just my only minor complaint about it, was that they take the sex out of James Bond, and that's...
And another shame about that is because I think even if the target demo is guys, I think a lot of guys learn how to be sexy by watching movies like James Bond, or try to learn how to be sexy by trying to emulate guys like James
Absolutely.
Bond.
Absolutely. I mean, you could chart them all the way starting back at the beginning. I mean, you go from sexy, 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 now to just he's hot, but... They're trying to make him more brooding and serious, and in so doing, they have to take away the sex, which, I mean, it's not totally gone. Like, he still flirts with Monty Penny, and he does sleep with a couple of women, but...
It's almost like he's teasing her, though, in a way.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's like he's really a cock tease in this movie.
He is, but I would like to have seen him more of a cock tease, a little bit more of one. Like, I liked that.
A little more cock and a little less tease.
Thank you.
Always.
Motto. He's such a hottie, dude.
As the one straight guy in the group, I even have to agree with that. He's a very sexy man.
He really, really is. He's heartbreakingly good looking. But he was sexier in Dragon Tattoo than in this, I'm sorry to say. But, oh well. Can't have everything.
That's another great movie that suffered from, I think, from not having enough chance for the actors to really really have any great monologues. It was an excellent movie otherwise, but it was too much. It was too plotty. Had too much exposition and too much action.
You know what? You're right about the monologue thing. I never really thought about that, but that's so true. You know, and Lincoln, you definitely have a lot of really good monologues, juicy monologues by a lot of different characters. Mm-hmm. Sally Field has one. Dandy Lewis.
She's got a couple.
Yeah, and he does, too. He has a couple. Tommy Lee Jones has one, you know. Joseph Gordon-Levitt in his tiny part has one.
The actors really love that, and the audiences love it because those are the moments that really grab you by the heart.
Yeah. Oh, dear. I can't believe that Daniel Day-Lewis has to break a record to win an Oscar. Oh, man, that sucks.
Well, let's try to think, though, that it's not a record that hasn't been broken by women. So at least Katharine Hepburn did sort of pave the way. She's broke the ceiling on the distaff side.
Right, so we know it is possible. It's just never happened before. Yeah. Well, I guess if Time Magazine calls you the world's greatest actor, then you have a better chance of breaking the record.
No pressure.
No pressure. He's so good, though. He kills it. He kills it. It's his best performance, I think, better than the two he won for. He's great in There Will Be Blood, and he's great in My Left Foot, but for me, this is a harder part because he doesn't just get to explode all over the screen. I also loved him in Gangs of New York, by the way. I thought he was great in that, and I love him in Age of Innocence and My Beautiful Laundrette and Unbearable Lightness of Being. All those are great Daniel Day-Lewis. Room with a View, he's hilarious in that. But to me, his Lincoln just tops them all. I would have no problem voting for him Best Actor. He's going to win the SAG, let's face it. Because he's never won a SAG, I don't think. Oh, no, did he win for There Will Be Blood? Yeah,
I think he did. He did, yes, he did for sure.
Yeah, because he won everything that year.
Yeah. We were talking about older actors before. I don't think that Lincoln is a role that he could have pulled off quite as well as a younger man.
Right, and I don't either.
He just, maybe it's partly makeup, but a lot of it is his actual face and just the wealth of experience he brings to it.
Absolutely. I also think he's really famous for basing his performance on people he knows or that some other characters, like John Huston was a big inspiration for There Will Be Blood. Well, I'll bet you anything it'll turn out that this will be true. And I have never heard it or read it anywhere. I'm just going to throw this out there that I'll bet you he based Lincoln on Arthur Miller, who's Rebecca Miller's dad and who he's married to. And he spent a lot of time with Arthur Miller before he died. And I'll bet you he based a lot of this character on that person. I actually met Arthur Miller once. I shook his hand when I was a young person.
Physically, vocally, or in what way do you think?
Just in his own observations. Like, you know, I think he brings, kind of the way that Johnny Depp brought Keith Richards into his performance for, Pirates. I think that Daniel Day-Lewis does that a little bit. He brings a person into himself. And I bet I'll bet you it'll turn out that it's Arthur Miller. I would like to find out if I was right about that. If I ever get a chance to interview him, I'll ask him. But it's just in the way, in his quiet way that he spoke and the way that he contemplates things before he speaks as Lincoln. And he was just so patient with himself, and Spielberg was patient with him. He happened to pick a really great screenwriter and a really great team of actors for this, so he could rely on them, but Daniel Day-Lewis takes his time when he tells a story, and little tiny moments, like he's just thinking about something, or he's staring out the window, or these tiny, delicate moments are just so powerful.
I'm so glad they waited. Remember, it seems like this movie has been in pre-production for years. It seemed like it was actually never going to happen. Remember when Liam Neeson was going to be Lincoln?
Oh, yeah, right. So you're right. It has been going on a long time.
Yeah. I'll have to go back to the recording, but I could swear that the production designer yesterday said that he originally got involved in the project in 2001.
Wow.
So it was in some shape or form 10 years ago.
All right, well, are we done?
Oh, we were done hours ago, sweetheart.
A lot. I don't know if we had a lot to say, but we sure kept talking.
As always.
Yes, absolutely. Loved it.
And we'll talk next week. You've been listening to Episode 7 of Oscar Podcast with Craig Kennedy from livinginCinema.com, Ryan Adams and Sasha Stone from awardsdaily.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Oscar Podcast. And the bumper music was If the News Makes You Sad, Don't Watch It by Broken Records, and I'm Your Man by Absentee. Thanks for listening.
you to come over here. 'Cause I have danced, and I've drunk, and I have